it would refuse to consider candidates as formally registered if they fail to provide all required documents, including a lack of criminal record and no history of dissent. And the new criteria have, by the way, been backed by 200 Iranian parliamentarians. Although candidates here like to stress they are independent, there's political currents in the background which they are either akin to or which back them up. To introduce the main currents participating in this year's elections, they are the current critical of the Rouhani government, that's Raisi, etc., the current aligned with the government, and the current supportive of the Rouhani government, which is reformists. This is not to forget independents running for office.
In a religious democracy, the people's votes are really influential and decisive. You have witnessed in the past elections, for example, that the whole electoral system was being managed and administered by a political faction, but someone from a rival party won the election. For instance, in 2005, when all the administrative bodies were supportive of Mr. Hashemi Rafsanjani, but people voted for Mr. Ahmadinejad, the same happened in 2013. This is a matter of pride.
In talking democracy, Mr. Naghavi Hosseini said why it's so important for a system to run on working political parties. Because Iran has hundreds of parties, but how functioning they are is another matter.
The fact that the person is elected but doesn't make good on his words afterwards goes back to the problem of not having a parties-based political system, because the candidate hasn't been backed by a party to be held accountable after winning the vote. The U.S. Democrats are accountable for the president's performance because it was the party that collected the votes. The president has won as a Democrat, but because the principle of parties hasn't been established well in Iran, the candidate feels free to do whatever he wants after taking office as president. It's because there's no party to admonish him.
592 candidates, including 40 women, had registered by May the 19th. I asked what gave the 40 women the confidence to apply as prospective presidential candidates this year.
This is the culmination of a series of policies that we've implemented that has been successful in terms of engaging women in the decision-making processes in the country. We started the beginning of this government 8 years ago. About 5% of the managers in the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran were women. Although it's stipulated in the constitution that women have no, there's no obstacle to women's advancement, Imam Khomeini, the leader, have never made any obstacle for women's engagement in politics or in running the affairs of the country. But there have been glass ceilings. What President Rouhani did was that he put forward a strategy, particularly from 2017, that is his second government. He set a quota that 30% of the managers appointed in this government have to be women.
What tends to happen in Iran is that candidates on each front tend to pull out in favor of the winning card closest to their camp.
It's important that candidates from the two rival political camps compete, even if it doesn't result in polarity of votes, but people have to be able to prefer one over the other. There has to be a meaningful ground for preference. We can say one of the candidates is good, but the other is better. Or I can remember there was a time that we said one of the candidates was bad, but the other was worse. So we need to do something so he wouldn't take over. What I believe is crucial is that people understand that our current economic and social situation isn't acceptable at all. Especially over the past 8 years, things haven't been improving, but even regressing. Of course, both domestic and foreign factors were involved, but proper management makes a difference.
To what extent would you say political factions in Iran have reached political maturity, having seen 4 decades of the revolution go by?
Certainly, political movements have gained the necessary maturity after some 40 years of activity in Iran. There are some occasions when they face problems and doubts, but it's not because they're not mature enough. There are other reasons for that. The main one is the lack of parties. We don't have large and relatively inclusive parties. They're too small.
Talking of parties, under Article 26 of the Constitution of Iran, the formation of parties, societies, political or professional associations, as well as religious societies, is permitted, provided they do not violate the principles of independence, freedom, national unity, the criteria of Islam, or the basis of the Islamic Republic. In the early years following the 1979 Islamic Revolution, political parties in this country were divided into right-wing and left-wing, basically in the economic sense. Today, most parties can be classed as principalist or reformist. These are 1990s adaptations of right-wing and left-wing. Then there are moderates, the incumbent Rouhani government, and independents, basically speaking. To move on to ideology or political agenda, principalists say politics and religion are inseparable. They support a minimized government role in the economy to the extent mentioned in the Constitution. They view the globalization of economy with skepticism, while putting special emphasis on retaining independence from foreign countries. Reformists, on the other hand, seek to execute the constitutional rights of the people and work toward enhancing political freedom. They opt for a promotion of interaction with the international community. As for the term moderates, it surfaced in 2013 with Hassan Rouhani's presidential election. Moderates are widely believed to be left-leaning. They advocate employing diplomacy and refraining from using harsh rhetoric.
The other end of the spectrum are reformists who believe in the principles of the Islamic Revolution, abide to the Constitution, but are very forward-looking in their policies. And they believe that we have to have a progressive approach when dealing with Islam, because Islam is a religion for all times, and we have to engage in a dialogue which should be constructive but also can be critical dialogue with our young generation to enable them to engage with the theoretical dimensions of the Islamic Revolution, to engage with some of the practical dimensions of what has happened all of these years. So this is what the reformists believe, and they believe that we need a constant reform of laws, of policy, of practices, to be able to preserve the principles and the spirit of the Islamic Revolution.
A spectrum of political party colors being out there is no accident. Iran calls for diversity among candidates in upcoming presidential elections. But given this is a religious democracy in contrast to a Western liberal democracy with no title, I asked if that actually meant all walks of life in Iran will be covered by varied candidates and political parties.
It's always been like this. I mean, during elections in Iran, we've always had candidates from the two major political camps, the reformists and principalists. It would certainly be the case in the upcoming vote, too.
Can you compare political factions post-revolution to pre-revolution?
Political parties that were active before the revolution were Shah's puppets. We used to have the Iran Novin Party and the People's Party. Shah dissolved both and formed the Rastakhiz Party and called it the Singhal Party, saying to anyone who'd oppose it to take their passport, obtain a visa for another country, and leave. There were no independent parties that relied on the people before the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution.
It's not just the 13th presidential elections the country will be holding on June the 18th, but the 6th election for the city and village councils, as well as midterm elections for the Islamic Consultative Assembly or Parliament. Also, the Assembly of Experts elections will be held on the same day in some provinces. Western political pundits, the media, politicians, frequently criticize this country for not being a democracy in their eyes. But not much is being said about authoritarian Arab kingdoms in the region. Why they can't see a democracy in common between religious democracy and Western liberal democracy calls for an answer.
Because they don't see their interests and their profits in the independence and the strength of the Islamic Republic. Because if the Islamic Republic of Iran proceeds as a successful model of an Islamic democracy in today's world, they're going to have a lot of problems with different entities which exist in the region, which are more or less dependent on Western governments for their economy or for their political system. They don't like to see a successful model of an independent state emerging.
That's it for today, but the story is only just beginning. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In its new report, Action on Armed Violence urges the states and others to commit politically to stop using explosive weapons with wide area effects in populated areas. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Study shows 91% of people killed or injured by explosives in global cities were civilians. Here's more. On the heels of the Zionist regime's recent bombardment of the Gaza Strip, a London-based charity revealed recently that civilians accounted for 91% of people killed or injured when explosive weapons were used in populated areas worldwide from 2011 to 2020. The new Action on Armed Violence, AOAV report, is based on data collected as part of the group's Explosive Violence Monitoring Project. It emphasizes that the data taken from English-language media reporting is not an attempt to capture every single casualty of every incident around the world. However, the report provides insight on the devastating impact of using explosive weapons, including airdrop bombs, artillery shells, improvised explosive devices or IEDs and mortars in densely populated areas, and demands global commitments to end such violence. Since the monitor began, AOAV has recorded the appalling suffering caused across the globe by both manufactured and improvised weapons, the report says. We call on states and other users to commit politically to stop using explosive weapons with wide area effects in populated areas. The harm recorded over the last 10 years and reflected in this report illustrates the stark urgency needed for a political declaration detailing such a commitment. AOAV tallied 357,370 deaths or injuries in 28,879 incidents across 123 countries and territories, and at least 262,413 of those casualties, or 73%, for civilians. Overall, explosive weapons killed 155,118 people, of which 92,588, or 60%, were civilians, and injured 202,252 people, of which 169,825, or 84%, were civilians. As the report details, civilians were most at risk when explosive weapons were used in populated areas, a well-established pattern of harm. 60% of all recorded incidents took place in populated areas. In those attacks, AOAV recorded 263,798 casualties. Civilians accounted for 91% of those killed or injured in populated areas. This compares to 25% of victims being reported as civilians when explosive weapons were used in areas not identified as highly populated areas. AOAV Executive Director Ian Overton told The Guardian the report clearly demonstrates that when explosive weapons are used in towns and cities, civilians will be harmed. That conclusion, he added, was as true as it is today in Gaza as it was a decade ago in Iraq and beyond. The highest numbers of civilian deaths and injuries were recorded in Syria, with 77,534, in Iraq with 56,316, in Afghanistan with 28,424, and in Pakistan with 20,719, and Yemen with 16,645 victims. Though Gaza and Lebanon ranked 9th and 13th in terms of civilian casualties by numbers, they had the highest percentages of deaths and injuries endured by civilians, about 90% and 91% respectively. IEDs were responsible for 52% of all deaths and injuries, while manufactured explosive weapons accounted for another 47%. In other events, both types were used. AOAV points out that the consequences of such incidents are not limited to immediate deaths and injuries, highlighting that further casualties have been caused by reverberating impacts. Explosive remnants of war contaminate the land, posing a risk to civilians for generations and frequently preventing local populations from returning or using the land for livelihood activities, explains the report. The destruction of civilian infrastructure takes years to repair and can leave civilians without access to clean drinking water and sanitation facilities, or prevent access to services such as healthcare, AOAV continues. Such impacts cost further lives, exacerbate the mental health impact for survivors, and see rises in poverty and disease. In an effort to prevent future casualties and damage, Ireland put forth a draft political declaration for strengthening the protection of civilians from humanitarian harm arising from the use of explosive weapons in populated areas in January and has welcomed comments on the proposal. The International Committee of the Red Cross is among the parties that have offered comments, stating that in the ICRC's view, the revised draft provides a solid basis for further work towards clear and concrete political commitments to strengthen the protection of civilians from harm caused by these weapons, and detailing some recommendations aimed at clarifying and strengthening the text. According to AOAV's report, for civilians living in conflict zones, this declaration cannot come soon enough. States and civil society must ensure that stronger standards are not watered down by states that reject the need for constraints. States should also seek to improve their policies and practices in light of the harm that is predicted when explosive weapons are used in populated areas, the group adds. The international community must not only take note of the scale of the figures we have included in this report, but be cognizant of the fact that each number represents a life, frequently young and almost always a civilian. Earlier this month, the Zionist regime's assault of Gaza, which included the destruction of medical facilities and apartment buildings, one of which housed international media offices, killed at least 248 Palestinians, including 66 children, and wounded over 1,900 people, according to local health officials.
Debate. Hello and warm welcome to another edition of the Debate on Matters. Welcome. The French president has recognized his country's role in the Rwandan genocide while leaving a wreath on a mass grave of the victims. Emmanuel Macron is set to try to reset French relations with Rwanda after years of accusations of French complicity in the 1994 atrocities. A March report by a French inquiry said that colonial attitude had blinded French officials, whose country bore a serious and overwhelming responsibility for not foreseeing the slaughter. And tonight's debate show will briefly review the history of French colonialism. Stay tuned.
On April 6, 1994, an airplane carrying then Rwandan president Juvenal Habyarimana was shot down as it prepared to land in Kigali, killing everyone on board. Military commanders of Rwanda's Hutu-dominated republic announced the president's death, blaming the Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, an organization dominated by the rival Tutsi minority, for the attack. Within a few hours, the commanders ordered people of Hutu identity to spare no Tutsi in the country, including infants. The mass killings went on for around 100 days, leaving at least 800,000 people dead. During Habyarimana's years in power, France maintained close relations with him as part of its France-Afrique policy. The French assisted Rwanda militarily against the RPF during the country's civil war in the years before the massacre. In the first few days of the genocide, Paris launched a military operation to evacuate French expatriates from Rwanda, refusing to allow any Tutsis to accompany them. According to the Human Rights Watch, the French military presence after the killings also effectively helped the perpetrators of the genocide to escape to neighboring countries.
From 1990 to 1995, French decision-makers decided to maintain Rwanda in the country's zone of influence. They decided to arm the regime and to support the Hutu extremists against Tutsis before, during, and even after the genocide. The French authorities had been perfectly informed on the issue.
The question of France's role and responsibility in the genocide has burned between the two nations for decades. However, ties have warmed under French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron made a symbolic visit to Rwanda after three decades of diplomatic tensions. His highly anticipated speech fell short of a formal apology, but he recognized his country's responsibility.
Ever since 27 years of bitter distance passed, 27 years of incomprehension, of a sincere attempt to get closer that was unsuccessful, 27 years of suffering for those whose intimate stories remain mishandled because of the antagonism of the memory, and so with modesty and respect by your side today, I come to recognize our responsibility.
Even though the French president tried to reconcile with Rwandan people, genocide survivors were disappointed at Macron's failure to offer a clear apology.
We remember the French who went to the checkpoints, who worked with the ex-government, and who helped them to distinguish between the Tutsis and the Hutus. I mean, it is very... we cannot forget that easily. We need to be honest. They have participated. They helped. It was time to say sorry, without going around it.
The official report of the latest inquiry in France's role in the genocide commissioned by Macron in 2019 said that Paris was responsible but not an accomplice. The report, along with the lack of an apology from Macron, shows that France still does not want to admit its complicity in the 1994 genocide.
Let's now see who we have to join us on this tonight's debate show with some insight and contribution. We'll have independent writer and activist Dale T. McKinley in Johannesburg, and academic political commentator Mustafa Taraore, who's joining us from Paris. Good to have you both, gentlemen, on the show. Let's go to Dale. An NGO argues that France is complicit in the Rwanda genocide because it provided weapons to rebels, it also facilitated genocide, and also provided shelter to those who committed atrocity after the event. How would you judge the issue?
Well, it's very clear, I think, to anybody who was paying attention at the time, and obviously since then, and all of the different reports that have been done, is that there is absolutely French. As the ex-colonial power, predominantly in that region, bear a distinct responsibility for what happened, for the reasons that you mentioned in terms of arming, but more so because I think the French presence indicates a much more, I think, deeper colonial mentality when it comes, whether it's Rwanda or any other of the ex-colonies that France had power over, which is that it's a very patronizing kind of relationship, and whatever suits the French, that's what they'll do. So when it was the Hutu regime, and when they were carrying out the atrocities, and when the genocide began, and it was very clear, the French turned a blind eye because it was in their interest to do so. And the same would go for many places in West Africa and otherwise. This is consistent with a colonial mentality that not only the French, but the British, the Portuguese, and many of the ex-colonial powers in Africa have always had and continue to have to this day. So while it's good that there is a degree of recognition and a degree of responsibility being taken, I would definitely agree with the Rwandan genocide survivors that it does not go far enough.
Okay. Now, Mustafa, a French inquiry has absolved France of direct complicity in the killing of 800,000 Tutsis, something that Macron avoided mentioning in his speech at the genocide memorial. Is France not complicit in the genocide?
I think France is complicit in the genocide. When you know that genocide is going to take place and you provide these people who want to commit the genocide with weapons and shelter after, it means that you take part in a genocide. So it's not just a complicit, it is even taking part in the genocide. Mm-hmm. So France took part in the genocide and France is not ready to really apologize. So it is the first step, what happened today with Macron, but this is not enough. And there's something I'm very concerned with is normally when we speak of a genocide, there's a reparation. So this is what generally what happens whenever you've got the question of a genocide. So now we will see if something is going to come after the recognition of the responsibility of France. Mm-hmm. What is the next step? Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of reparation? That's my first point. My second point is this one. What is to blame here is the French colonial attitude. What was done since 1994 to get rid of this French attitude? Because we know that this is a French know-how.
Right.
Okay. What? Where were they educated? Are the French educated about it, about genocide and how to behave and how to deal with African continents? Has things changed? I'm not sure.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right, Dale, what makes Macron fail to make an open apology for the Rwandan bloodbath?
Well, like all good politicians, generally Macron, he covers all of his bases. So when any country, particularly a European superpower such as France and an ex-colonial power, comes into the African continent and in this case tries to sort of patch things up in the, with Rwanda in this case, what's the consideration for Macron is domestic politics, how it looks at home. There are upcoming French elections next year. Macron comes from a center-right ideological position, which has fairly close ties with the French military, and also was a fairly accepting of the French colonial adventures, and also then what we've called neo-colonial adventures in the last 20 or 30 years in West Africa and other places of influence. So there are domestic issues at play where he needs to shore up his own support. He won't go too far. That's why he didn't issue an apology. But he needs to make it appear as though at least he is sincere and they want to mend relations, precisely because I think Macron also wants to be a player on the world stage. So in this way, he looks diplomatic. He covers his domestic policy bases, but he also repairs certain relations in Africa and makes France look better. So in that case, he's being the quintessential politician.
Mustafa, France has a dark history of colonialism in Africa, as you know, especially in Algeria and the War of Independence, where the government said that more than 1 million people lost their lives. Let's have your take on that.
Yes, I think it is not just part of history. It is happening even now. If you look at the situation in Mali, 2 days ago, we had a coup d'etat. And the reason why is because France was involved in it, because France wants to split Mali, okay? And so, which means that they had corrupt the leaders of the president of Mali and the prime minister, okay? So, who is providing the terrorists with weapons in the north of Mali, in a zone where the Malian army is not allowed, but the French army is allowed? Okay. So this is another question. So I think that this is it's not just part of history. It has always been the case. The only time France failed was with the Algerian War in 1962. So it's very important that we think about this one and we remember it. It's not just the French government that is responsible. The French population is partly responsible because it is something they prefer to ignore. We all know that France is in debt. If you look at the debt, the French debt, taking into account the French GDP, it is the most important debt in Europe. Where is France going to get its money? In Africa. So this is why what happened with Rwanda, I see it as just an other trick. It is just a trick. France needs Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of what they have to do is a fair kind of apology regarding what happened. But we know that what they did, they are doing it again. They are still doing it, and they were not taught how to do things differently.
Now, Dale, is France's half-hearted mission of responsibility a new strategy for reviving the influence that it's lost in Africa?
Well, I think that Macron, as I said, Macron has, since he came to be the president of France, has wanted to play the world stage. He's wanted to sort of, I think, reassert French influence. And where best to do that, where better to do that than in Africa, the former colonial playground, where there are, you know, economic ties, there's cultural ties, linguistic ties, and other kinds of things. So, yes, when when places and like France, in places like France, which are in, as the other commentator was saying, in economic difficulties, particularly now, France and others, they search outward for influence, for new forms of accumulation, for new ways of making influence. And Macron sees, I think, West Africa and Central Africa as the place to do that. Everybody knows that the key in Africa in terms of economically is its natural resources. It always has been. Mm-hmm. And the colonial powers have tried to maintain influence on this front in order to have that pipeline of natural resources, but also geostrategic influences. So what has gone on in North Africa over the last 20 years, in Libya, in Morocco, in Tunisia, Mali, Mauritania, all over the place, and then, of course, back in even Nigeria and across the Horn of Africa. If the French can play that kind of role as a mediator and then also as a as an offensive military force to deal with terrorist influences and other kinds of things, then it can project that power on a world stage. And I think Macron wants to do that. You can tell that this is exactly what he wants to do. At the same time, there are fundamentally, as we started this conversation, at the heart of that are the self-interests, the interests of France themselves and the ruling class in France, which has huge economic ties, which has a lot invested in Africa. And in that case, there are very specific economic reasons for this kind of recalibrating and re-strategizing kind of role. As the world itself becomes more sort of unpredictable and things become a little bit less certain, countries like France are going to move into these gaps that they can find to reassert themselves both politically, economically, and militarily.
Okay, interesting analysis. Mustafa, as you may recall, the French Air Force played a leading role in Libya that helped topple longtime ruler there, Muammar Gaddafi. Tell us about this French intervention and what France was doing there in Libya.
Yes, we all know the reason why Gaddafi was assassinated. He was assassinated by the French directly. And the reason why is because he had some projects for the African continent. He wanted to work towards the independence, the real independence of all African nations in terms of currency, technology, communication. And this is the main reason why he was assassinated. It's not just me saying it, okay? You got lots of well-documented reports on it. Okay. So this is why, and of course, because they control the media, they made us believe that Gaddafi was about to massacre his population as if he was a crazy man. I'm not saying that Gaddafi was perfect, but we knew what was going to happen. Many African countries, Mali included, spoke and said that it was very dangerous to get rid of Gaddafi, that it was going to destabilize the region. They were not listened to. How can you go to a continent and not listen to the people from that continent when they warn you about what is going to happen? What is the situation today in Libya? Libyans, you used to see them very often in the UK, going to the university and going back to Libya, not even immigrating to Western Europe. Now, you've got lots of them in Paris begging. What is that? If you look at the statistics, if you look at the economy, how strong the economy was in Libya, it was maybe one of the most of the best economies in the African continent, with South Africa and Algeria. What is the situation today? Can you go and say that you are going to be educated in Libya? Where are the universities? Are the people learning? No. What they are just doing now, they are just exploiting the oil. And with that, became the problem we have now in Mali. They just promised to a minority group a kind of independence. That is not possible. We Africans are not defined by countries. Countries got no meaning to us. Ethnicity, yes, but one nation is composed of different ethnic groups. There's nothing like mono ethnic, mono religious. No, we are all composed of different people, and this is the strength of Africa. You can be from the north, you can be Pulan, you can be Tuareg, you can be Mandingo, we are all Malians. There's no distinction. Different cultures, different languages, different ethnic groups in one nation. And this is real tolerance, democracy, and this is what the United States is trying to do. All the nations saying that, okay, we are going to work towards multiculturalism and all these things. We have it in Africa. We don't have to look at what's happening in the United States to learn about multiculturalism or in the UK. We have it in Africa.
Okay. Now, Dale, on the heels of French involvement in Libya, then we had the unilateral intervention in Mali in 2013 that seemed to confirm Paris's willingness to be forceful on the world stage, while at the same time it took a backseat in the Middle East and even objected to the US-led invasion of Iraq. Let's have your take on that.
Well, when countries such as France, powers such as France sitting on the UN Security Council, like the others there, when they play on the geostrategic terrain of the world, it's always going to be contradictory because different places are with different interests. So, for example, let's take the Middle East, where France and many of the European countries were against the U.S. Actions in Iraq and saying, no, we should pull out, and they should pull out and shouldn't have such a militarized state of things, while at the same time, as you mentioned, they're militarizing West Africa in exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. So it all depends on what interest, economic, what political, and what geostrategic interests are playing themselves out in different parts of the world. The United States does this all the time. So on one side, they'll be very, very critical of China and their human rights record. And then when it comes to, for example, let's say another country in South America or in Africa, which is just as authoritarian or even much worse than the Chinese, they'll keep quiet because it's in their geostrategic or in their economic interests, or because they need an ally for particular reasons, other politically, to play themselves out. The French played this game very well in the area, in the neighborhood. So it's not surprising. French are not alone in this, but in the context of wanting to, how should I say, be heard, and be heard by different voices on the international stage, what the French have done, the contradictory stances they've taken in West Africa versus the Middle East or somewhere else, are consistent with a particular foreign policy that is contradictory in itself, because that contradiction has no principle necessarily. It's not a principle of solidarity. It's not a principle of assistance. It's a principle of self-interest. And self-interest changes according to what is at play.
Okay,
so
I have to jump in. I'm sorry. That's all the time that we have had. Let me thank our guests. We had independent writer and activist Dale T. McKinley from Johannesburg, and academic and political commentator Mustafa Taraore in Paris. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new study published in the scientific journal Environmental Research suggests the connection between an increase in the Earth's temperature and more stillbirths. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Matteo Rozza Ryder. This article is published under the heading "Climate Crisis May Lead to Rising Stillbirths." Stay tuned for more. Climate change is perhaps the greatest existential threat that humanity has ever faced. And as environmental research accumulates, we keep discovering unexpected side effects of making industrial civilization reliant on fossil fuels. The latest one, a likely link between global warming and increased numbers of stillbirths. A new study published in the scientific journal Environmental Research suggests a connection between an increase in the Earth's temperature and more stillbirths. Authors from the University of Queensland found that pregnant women who were exposed to extreme ambient temperatures during their pregnancy seemed to be at an increased risk of stillbirth, especially later in the pregnancy. Scholars at their School of Earth and Environmental Science and Mater Research Institute reviewed 12 studies with relevant data in their study. An estimated 17-19% of stillbirths are potentially attributable to chronic exposure to extreme hot and cold temperatures during pregnancy, the authors note. Climate change can have a multitude of impacts on an individual's health, especially among vulnerable populations, the research team behind the study told reporters by mail. For pregnant mothers, extreme weather events can impact access to antenatal services and increased risk of heat-related illnesses. Mothers living in low-resource settings are particularly vulnerable to these effects. In a press release regarding the study, environmental scientist Dr. Scott Lisk described how their conclusions suggest that marginalized populations, which already struggle disproportionately due to lack of resources, will be even harder hit as global temperatures rise and they suffer more miscarriages. More than 2 million stillbirths occur every year around the world, with the most occurring in low-resource settings, Dr. Lisk said in a press release. Not only are these poorer countries already affected disproportionately by stillbirths, they are now going to be disproportionately affected by climate change as well. If the link apparent in this research bears out upon further scrutiny, the majority of new stillbirths will occur invariably in the nations already suffering the most. The the scholars emphasize that much additional work needs to be done to fully understand the science at play here. To fully understand the effects of maternal exposure to ambient temperatures and stillbirth, future studies should focus on the biological mechanisms involved and contributing factors, in addition to improving measurement of ambient temperature exposure. Professor Vicky Felnati, director of the Center of Research Excellence in Stillbirth, Stillbirth, CRE, at Mater Research, said in a press release. In the meantime, we would encourage pregnant women to talk to their healthcare providers about staying safe during the cold days of winter and hot days of summer. The research team told reporters that they are interested in learning more about the ways our environment impacts stillbirth risks and chose to study ambient temperature exposure during pregnancy as an initial step. The NHMRC Stillbirth CRE research program addresses priorities across four major program areas, including improving stillbirth data to drive change, identifying new approaches to stillbirth prevention, they wrote to reporters. This review helped us to identify an important gap in data as well as highlighting a potential area where stillbirth risk could be improved in the future. The possible rise in a stillbirth is only the latest in a series of red flags indicating that pollution and greenhouse gas emissions are making Earth less habitable. According to the World Wildlife Fund, the population sizes of mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish have fallen by 68% since 1970, amounting to an unprecedented decline in Earth's biodiversity. Over the last two centuries, humans have destroyed one-third of the planet's forest cover and overfished one-third of the world's fish stocks. We also continue to churn out plastic products that clog up our oceans, clutter up our land, and contain chemicals that have been linked to ominously declining sperm counts.